So, hello and welcome to Physica Fantastica, the physics of innovation. Three key words here: explore, understand, and build. So by way of an introduction here, let's have a look at this guy. This guy has a virtual reality helmet on. And that leads us to the central question for the next hour, and that is, what is reality? So I used to think I knew, you know, that chair over there, in reality, is made of atoms, which in turn are made of protons, neutrons, and electrons. And then I became a theoretical physicist, and now I have no clue what that chair actually is. With string theory and extra dimensions, what is it? I'd have no clue. All right, so our understanding of reality is reflected in our ability to simulate reality. Okay, so check out this cool simulated reality I found on YouTube. Okay, so what we see here is a very tall person made out of crates, and a guy comes running up, and he grabs a crate out from the bottom, and he yanks it out, and the whole thing comes tumbling down in a very realistic-looking fashion, I might add. That kind of simulated reality runs on a gaming computer. How many of you are gaming computer enthusiasts? in a room full of high school students, I must add, it's 75% of students like this. Okay, so what's interesting is that, what tells that gaming computer what to do is something called a physics engine. Encoded in that physics engine are the laws of nature, how we understand things work, what we understand reality to be. Fact is, what's on the screen appears to be quite high-tech, and indeed it is. However, the laws of physics encoded in that physics engine date way back to this guy, Sir Isaac Newton. Since that time, of course, theoretical physicists have realized that reality goes much deeper than this. Our understanding of reality progresses in levels. For example, we start with Newton, and then people like Maxwell, and then Einstein, and Stephen Hawking, and people today, other people today. And so it's a little bit like a video game. Okay, in a video game, we are at, say, level one. The rules are pretty simple, but we can't do very much in our world. Then we progress to level two. The rules get more complicated. The world we are in gets more interesting. We have more powers. Okay, so our understanding of reality is a bit like that, in levels. The difference is that our understanding of reality, we're at some level of understanding right now, but we have no idea how deep it actually goes. Unlike a video game, when you buy the video game, you know, oh, there's just 10 levels. When I get to level 10, then I rule, right? But with study of reality, we have no idea how deep it actually goes. Moreover, rather than just a game, this is reality. So here's an example of a reality out there, okay? A supermassive black hole consuming stars and like ejecting huge high-energy jets of particles and radiation. A black hole where gravity is so intense that not even light can escape. Way cool stuff out there, right? Yes, way cool? Way cool stuff out there. At least a very cool picture, okay? Now we might wonder, well, okay, so what? Yeah, all that stuff is out there, really, really cool. What does it have to do with me in my day-to-day life? Well, it turns out actually quite a lot, because it turns out that understanding reality is just like that. What is space? What is time? What is gravity? What is matter? What is energy? Really, really basic questions like that. Turns out that even partial answers to questions like that empower us to innovate, are our most potent source of ideas to create new technologies. Okay, so the basic reason is that anything that we build, any technology that we create, must function within the laws of nature. So the better we understand those laws, then the more important, the more beneficial, the more useful, the more powerful technologies we can create. Okay, so this is the physics of innovation. It's a cycle. It consists of three steps. The first is we explore the mysteries of our universe. Never let yourself be fooled into thinking that we had creative geniuses like Albert Einstein who answered all the questions. Of course, that's not true. Albert Einstein was just one of those guys who opened up more questions than most. Okay, so we explore those mysteries, and that leads to a deeper understanding of what reality actually is. It takes us up a notch in this video game to a higher level of gameplay where we have more powers to build cool stuff. Okay, so that's what we're going to talk about. I'm going to talk about this physics of innovation cycle in the context of four really important ideas that transformed the world. Electromagnetism, special relativity, general relativity, and quantum ideas. All right, so let's begin with electromagnetism. So, does someone have a cell phone in the audience that I could borrow? Oh, thank you, thank you. Oh, wow, that's very, very slick. Looks cool. Oh, nice picture, nice picture. Do you use this often? Occasionally? Yeah, occasionally. Once a minute or so? All right, okay, very useful little bit of technology. Well, how would you feel if I smashed it on the ground and jumped up and down on it? Okay, where would you get another one?
Store.
The store. Where does the store get it from?
Factory.
Okay, how does the people in the factory know how to build this thing? There's some engineers. How do the engineers know how, where did they get the understanding to build that from? Science. And where does that come from, et cetera, et cetera? So that's the kind of question that I want to ask here. Ultimately, where does this come from? If all cell phones and anyone who knew anything about cell phones, indeed science in general, were to suddenly vanish from the planet, where would we have to start again in order to build up to be able to build a technology like a cell phone? That's the kind of question I want to ask. So it turns out that for the case of the cell phone, we needed to explore the mysteries of what are electricity and magnetism. So let's just have a look at magnetism, for example. So this is another simulated reality, a notch up of from our falling crates guy. Okay, so this is playing with magnets. How many of you have played with magnets? Okay, so this is a very realistic looking simulation. It looks like a video, but it's actually created entirely within a computer. Okay. This one in particular is extremely realistic looking. And the question is, how can we create such realistic looking simulations? Well, we create it by having a deeper understanding of what's actually going on. Okay, so when you see that magnet attracting that ball, the magnet and the ball do not attract each other directly. What happens is there is a magnetic field created in the space around those objects. And it is the magnetic field that is doing the attracting, like a bunch of elastic bands. Those two objects do not attract each other directly. It's the field that plays the important role. That understanding that objects can be surrounded by electric and magnetic fields, and that's how nature gets stuff done, has been enormously important in a huge range of technologies. Okay, so if we combine the idea of electric fields with magnetic fields, then we get electromagnetism. And this was an extremely deep, challenging mystery. It took an enormous amount of creative genius to figure this out. Lots of people were involved. The guy who put the finishing touches on is this guy, James Clerk Maxwell. Little boy genius. He put the ideas of electromagnetism in the language of nature, the language of mathematics. How many of you are looking at the mathematics and saying, ah, mathematics? Fortunately, we don't need to understand the details of that mathematics, but we will see that those mathematical ideas contain very, very, very powerful ideas. All right, so in particular, what they allowed Maxwell to do is discover that electric and magnetic fields can move through empty space, like a wave, and they move at a speed of 3 times 10 to the 8 meters per second. Okay, so what else moves at that speed? Light. Right, so Maxwell put two and two together, and he said, oh, that's what light is. That must be what light is. And so so this is an example, an animation of a very elementary source of light emitting electromagnetic radiation, electromagnetic waves. When I look at this animation, I think this is really, really remarkable, because ever since, I'm sure, the dawn of human consciousness, people have looked around and wondered, what is this amazing stuff called light that comes to us from the sun and warms our planet and that lights the area around our campfires at night? What is this magical stuff? Fantastic stuff. For thousands and thousands and thousands of years, people have wondered about that, and only in the 1860s was it finally realized what light actually is. And what it is nature's ability to transport pure energy from here to here at about 1 billion kilometers per hour. Whew. Okay, that's a cool trick. Okay, now we know how nature can do it, we can do it too. Turns out that this understanding called electromagnetism touched closer to the heart of how nature works, the gears and wheels behind the scenes making reality possible, than any idea that had come before. And it was so powerful that what followed was a massive explosion of applications that is still reverberating across the world today. Let's start with cool stuff we build the entire telecommunications industry. So we built, for example, the telephone, and then the radio, and now satellite radio, and then the television, and now satellite TV, and worldwide communication networks, a worldwide cable network, a worldwide microwave network, allowing us to talk on our cell phones, a worldwide satellite network. Look at all the satellites we've launched up there over the years. The world is connected. And a big part of that connectivity, of course, is the internet. When you're doing stuff like Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, our ability to do that stuff is in large part due to the power of ideas in those four little equations. Really, really fantastic. And of course, we can build cell phones. They work by electromagnetic waves. Okay, so I'm talking on my cell phone, great, great, great. I'm talking for too long, and what eventually happens? The battery dies. Got to plug the thing in. Okay, so in fact, we plug in lots of things. Okay, Maxwell's equations have given us the ability, the know-how, the tools to construct an enormous array of devices that we plug in to make our lives more convenient, more productive, great entertainment value, all kinds of things to really, really improve the quality of human life on this planet. Like, for example, can't live without that fridge. You know, all kinds of things. And maybe in the future, more electric cars. That would be cappuccino. Can't live without that. Many, many, many technologies. And if you think about it, I'm sure you can think of many more. It has really, really had a huge impact on our world. And, you know, microwave ovens and mowing our lawns and industry. Huge, huge applications in industry and in transportation. We all need a lava lamp. and big-scale transportation. So most large cities have a subway system, and so mass transport of people to and from work and so on, we plug that thing in. Okay, so we've had 150 years to develop and come up with devices that we plug in. And I thought, well, what device represents the epitome, the peak of human achievement in the category of stuff we plug in, the coolest thing? Okay, so I searched long and hard. When I found it, I knew instantly I had it. It's the Hello Kitty electric fan, the perfect fusion of form and function. Okay, we plug in entire industries. Productivities of countries depend on the ability to plug in machines. We plug in entire cities. This is the world at night. Our ability to light our streets and our factories and our homes and continue our productivity and so on after the sun goes down has had such a tremendous impact on humanity, on the world, that we can see it from space. That's really freaky to me. That's just amazing. So, question. We have all this stuff that we plug in. We plug it into the grid, but into what do we plug the grid? Where does all this energy come from? Da-da-da-da! Maxwell's equations come to the rescue again. And we build more cool stuff. We build electric power generators. So this is a model of an electric power generator. And it's just to show you that, indeed, electric and magnetic fields are involved. We just take a yellow loop of wire. We turn it in a magnetic field, which is the red lines there. And voila, according to Maxwell's equations, electric current flows in that wire. And we can use that to light our light bulbs and so on and so forth. The cleanest and most versatile form of energy the world has ever known. Okay, so, great. So this is fantastic, except we need something to turn that crank. What do we use to turn that crank? Okay, well, human beings are clever creatures, and they've come up with many ways of turning the crank. So one is we use the energy in falling water. Where does that energy come from, ultimately? The sun, right. So the sun warms the oceans. Water evaporates, it passes over the continents, it cools, it falls as rain, a river flows to the ocean, and we catch some energy along the way. Okay, wind, same thing. Okay, wind energy also ultimately comes from the sun. Or we could just focus the sun's rays. How many of you played with a magnifying glass as a kid and focused the sun's rays, got something hot? Okay, so same idea here. We heat water, and when we boil it, we get steam, we run a turbine, and that turns our crank and supplies energy for the world. Okay, fantastic. So ultimately, most of the energy sources that human beings use on this planet are actually indirectly connected to the sun. We are actually indirectly plugging into the sun. Okay, so people who think about this say, well, okay, we have all these things we're indirectly plugging into the sun. What if we could build an artificial sun here, right on the planet, and plug in directly into that thing? That would be amazing, right? Okay, so before we can do that, we need to understand how our real sun works. So look at that thing. This gigantic fire-breathing dragon of a beast floating out there in the middle of empty space, pumping out tons and tons of energy, doing this day after day after day for billions of years. Where does all that energy come from? Huh? Huh? Fusion, thank you. So that answer, fusion, actually didn't come to us directly. It came to us by exploring, first, a seemingly totally unrelated mystery, and that is the mystery of what is space and what is time. So we're shifting to our second of the big ideas that changed the world, and that is called special relativity. Okay, so who amongst all the people on the planet over the history of humanity has had a lot to say about our understanding of what space and time are? Albert Einstein, right, okay. So what Albert Einstein did is he basically took us from this level of gameplay to this level of gameplay, okay? And so it's a lot of fun. I want to show you how we needed to think differently, how Einstein, what he discovered made us think differently about what space and time are. Okay, so let's bring Einstein up here, well, at least his head, and we'll give him a Da Vinci body. And we'll give him some clocks so that he can tell time. And we'll give him a ruler so that he can measure distance, space. And we will give ourselves a clock and a ruler. So right now, nothing interesting is happening. Okay, Einstein's clocks move at the same rate as our clock. Einstein's ruler is the same length as our ruler. But now, we're going to make Einstein drift across the stage. And something's going to change. And I want you to point out what's different about this moving Einstein compared to the Einstein at rest. Just yell it out. Yes, so he compressed, so he's gotten skinny. Slower time. His clocks are moving more slowly than our clock. And they're not the same time. Okay, so let me talk a little bit about each of those. So first off, this shrinking Einstein. So if Einstein were standing right here, I could touch both of his shoulders at the same time by holding my hands this far apart and going tunk and touching them. Now suppose Einstein is whipping by us like this. Okay, then I find that in order to touch both of his shoulders simultaneously, I have to move my hands in quite close, like this. He whips by, and as he whips by, I go tunk and momentarily touch both of his shoulders. The fact that my hands are so close together means that Einstein really occupies this smaller space. Einstein occupies less of our space than his own space. Isn't that freaky? I think that's cool. Second thing is Einstein's clocks are running slower than our clocks. Okay, time, moving clocks run slow, and we'll see an application of this shortly. Okay, the third thing is that you'll notice the two clocks are reading different times. I must say that for Einstein, they are reading the same time. So if I were to run and catch up with Einstein and look over his shoulders, I would see those clocks in sync. When one is 12, the other is 12. But when I stop, turn around, look at Einstein, they are reading different times. What does that mean concretely, physically, practically? What it means is, as Einstein drifts by like that, if I reach up and go like this and touch both of his clocks simultaneously, the clock I'm touching with my left hand is in the future of the clock I'm touching with my right hand, from Einstein's point of view. I touch them simultaneously. Einstein says, no, no, you touch this clock first, then this clock. Isn't that amazing? I think that's cool. That's really, really cool. Anyways, okay, so what does all this stuff mean? Well, ultimately, what Einstein showed is that we can't think about space and time separately anymore. They need to be thought about always together. Okay, they are unified. Okay, they are unified into like a little cube, a space-time cube, where one face is space, the other face is time. And when someone is moving relative to us, their little space-time cube gets tilted or rotated compared to our space-time cube. Okay, their experience of space and time is tilted, is rotated, is a little bit different from our experience. Space and time get mixed up like that. It's really, really remarkable. So this unification was hugely important. It basically, all of physics needed to be rewritten in terms of this new foundation. Okay? But it also had another important implication. Very, very quickly, it led to another unification, and that is E equals MC squared. Energy and mass are, in essence, the same thing. Okay? So energy can be converted into mass, and mass can be converted back into energy. And of course, that's fusion. That's what's happening in the center of the sun. Small nuclei are being fused together under the intense pressure at the heart of the sun, are being fused together into larger particles. And the larger particles have less mass. Mass is lost. Actually, it's not lost. It's converted into pure radiant energy, which blasts out of the sun and hits the Earth as sunlight, warming the planet, keeping it above nearly absolute zero, which is a good thing. Then we can have liquid water and life and all that kind of stuff. So basically, the fact that we can exist on this planet is because the sun is slowly decreasing in mass, trading its mass for a huge amount of energy. Okay, fantastic. So we understand how the sun works. Yay, yay, yay. Okay, but what can you do with it? Well, let's get back to our artificial sun. Okay, this I love this picture. This is a project called ITER. It stands for International Thermonuclear Experimental Reactor. It is one of the largest and most complex science and engineering projects in the history of humanity. And it's happening right now in the south of France being constructed. So just check out the scale. There's a little person at the bottom left there. And we see a cutaway view of a very large donut-shaped region. In that donut-shaped region, there will be a plasma. That's the kind of material inside a star. That it will be about 10 times as hot as the center of the sun. Okay? We will take the heat from that, and we will boil water and generate steam, run turbines, and supply the world with electric power. The genius of the human mind to be able to look up there at the sun, figure out how it works just by thinking about it, and construct something like that down here on the planet. Okay, the potential impact of this is enormous. The potential, it holds the potential to possibly, you know, supply the world with clean, almost virtually inexhaustible energy and very, very safe energy for essentially the rest of the human, for the rest of the existence of the human race on this planet, which is a really remarkable thing. All right. I have a little video here showing an earlier version of an artificial sun, a slightly scaled down version from ITER. This is amazing to me. Actually, it is a small artificial sun sparking up on our planet. Human beings made that. That is so cool. All right. So it has the enormous potential to help tremendously to transform our world from a fossil fuel burning kind of world to something a little more idyllic, like that. All right, so power of ideas. That equation is just a few letters from the alphabet, but it has an enormous amount of power in it. Okay, what makes the world go around? Ideas. That is one of the most powerful ideas human beings have ever had. All right, so let's shift gears to the third of our four big ideas that changed the world, and that is general relativity. All right, so the technology I want to focus on is this. What's that? GPS, Global Positioning System. Okay, I want to ask the same kind of question. Where ultimately does this come from? Okay, if all technology, if all science were to disappear from the planet, where would we have to begin again to be able to build a technology like that? Turns out an important mystery here is the mystery of what is gravity. So Newton told us something about gravity, something which this guy doesn't seem to understand. And then Einstein came along and told us something rather different about gravity. He took us again to that next level of gameplay. So Newton said that gravity is a force. Okay, this object here, it sure seems like the Earth is pulling down on this object, exerting a force on it. The fact is, there's no such thing. What's happening is something much more marvelous than that. What's happening is the mass of the Earth is warping space and time around it. Okay, warping of time, what does that mean? That means that the mass of the Earth warps time so that time moves more quickly up here than down here. If I have two identical twins and I hoist one up here and hold them up there all day, they are in a place where time moves more quickly than down here. So I bring them back down and compare. This twin, I find her nails have grown longer. Her hair has grown longer. She has had more thoughts. She is older than this twin because she has spent time in a place where time moves more quickly, you know, than down here. It's really, really quite remarkable. And the fact that this thing follows this arc trajectory has absolutely nothing to do with the Earth pulling down on it. It has everything to do with the way this thing experiences time at different altitudes and at different speeds. Right, so cool. So that's warping of time. Here's warping of space. Okay, so this is a reality out there. Two neutron stars orbiting around each other and spiraling in toward each other and eventually coalescing into, in this case, a black hole. Space is the green grid. Check out how it's vibrating like this, undulating waves of space going out. Okay, the very geometry of space is waving like this, is undulating, is warping. Okay, that's the nature of gravity. That's what gravity is. It's not a force. All right, so and even to create such an animation, a simulated reality, we need to understand what reality is at that deeper level. We need to understand a little bit about the geometry of space and time and how matter affects that and vice versa. And that is encoded in that really cool equation over there called Einstein's field equations. All right, super. So what can we do with that? Well, let's get back to the global positioning system. So so here's a picture of the GPS showing the satellites up there. How does it work? Okay, well, each one of those satellites has a very, very accurate clock in it. Okay, and so here's my GPS receiver. There's a satellite up there. It sends a radio signal down here with a timestamp on it. And so my receiver can determine the time it took the radio signal to get from that satellite to here. I know the radio signal moves at the speed of light. So the receiver can calculate the distance from that satellite to here, and from that satellite to here, from that satellite to here. We triangulate and we determine, and the GPS receiver determines where it is. Okay, so all of that requires a very, very accurate way of measuring time. So as I said, those satellites have atomic clocks in them, very, very accurate measurements of time. But the problem is that those satellites are in motion. Just like our Einstein, who was drifting across the stage and his clocks were going slower than ours, well, that's going to affect those satellites in the same way. Also, just like our identical twins here, one goes up here and experiences time more quickly. Time moves more quickly up here relative to down here. Okay, those satellites are up there. Time moves more quickly up there than it does down here. That's also going to affect the time. The fact is, if we didn't understand that gravity is not a force pulling down, but rather is a warping of space and time, the GPS system would fail in about 2 minutes. Okay, so we need this understanding. It is essential to build an extremely useful and powerful technology like the global positioning system, which tells us very, very accurately where we are. But of course, it can't do so without telling us very, very accurately when. And we need very, very accurate atomic clocks. All right, which is quantum technology, which I'm going to get to. All right, fantastic. So that's one example of what one can do with this deeper understanding of reality. All right, so let's move to our fourth and final big idea that changed the world, and that is quantum. The kind of technology I want to look at here is this. Okay, so that's a laptop computer, and same kind of question. Where does that thing come from, ultimately? What did we need to know about nature at a very basic level, space, time, gravity, matter, that kind of stuff, to build that thing? Well, it turns out that in this case, the mystery is quite an interesting mystery, and that is, how can atoms exist? So around the turn of the 20th century, early 1900s, people who think about things like atoms and so on, they came to the conclusion that atoms cannot exist in our universe. Okay? That seems a bit problematic to me because there's an atom. Oh, look, there's another one. Oh, look, they're all over the place. So how's this? Okay, so this is a problem, right? And the problem was people were thinking that an atom looks something like that. It looks like electrons orbiting the nucleus of the atom, much like planets orbit the sun. Fact is, such an atom can't exist in our universe. Okay? And so what was required was basis. What was happening basically is we were at this level of gameplay. The rules were not complicated enough or interesting enough to allow a universe in which atoms could exist. We had to go to the next level and understand those rules at a deeper level to have a more interesting universe, one in which atoms can actually exist. And that shift in gameplay is called quantum. All right, so basically this is now a modern picture of the atom, which I'm sure many of you have seen. And the slogan here is small is different. In essence, what's happening is in order for atoms to exist in our universe, it requires that the electron be able to do a very quirky trick inside the atom. It requires that electrons behave as if they can be in two places at once, okay? Or multiple places at once. Now, the last time I checked, I can be here or I can be here. I cannot be in two places at the same time. But that is, in essence, what the electron needs to appear to be able to do inside the atom for atoms to exist, for atoms to exist, for us to exist. It's really amazing. I think this is really cool. So, in short, electron can behave as if it is in two places at once. It has a very ghostly kind of existence inside the atom. This is going to be important for later on. Okay, so, again, this mystery, how atoms can exist, was very, very deep. And it took a lot of immense work and creative genius to unravel this one. And one of the guys who put the finishing touches on it is this guy, Erwin Schrödinger, and that's his equation. Okay? Very, 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 very powerful equation. Okay, so first of all, that's fantastic. Isn't that great? We now know how human beings can exist in this universe and all atoms and all that stuff. But what can it do for me practically? What kind of technology can it give me? Well, let's start with every electronic device on the planet. Okay, so here's a computer chip. Anything that has a transistor in it is quantum technology, okay, like this computer chip. And as soon as we have a computer chip, well, then we can build all kinds of computers, everything from laptop computers to supercomputers. Check out this simulated reality here. So at the very beginning, we had Newton's laws in a physics engine driving a gaming computer. Now we've upped the ante, and we've got our current best understanding of what reality is, okay, running a physics engine that is driving one of the world's most powerful supercomputers. And what can we do? Well, we can simulate the evolution of the entire universe from near the beginning of the Big Bang to the present. This is absolutely astounding. I mean, just a few hundred years ago, Galileo was, like, you know, dropping rocks off the Leaning Tower of Pisa and saying, oh, look, they hit the ground at the same time. And now we're like, we have supercomputers that simulate the evolution of the entire universe. That is absolutely astounding. Human beings are amazing, amazing creatures. All right. And, of course, it also allows us to build the cell phones. Okay? And actually many, many other electronic technologies. So, again, this is I just looked at over the internet and started downloading all these pictures and realized, you know, the more I look at it, the more I realize electronics is everywhere. And two of the really, really big applications is in computing and in communications. Okay, so computing, for example, basically we build our worlds, our world on a computer. We simulate bridges, we simulate buildings before we actually build them. So the ability to have powerful computers has had a huge transformative impact on engineering, and likewise an enormous impact on the way we do science. It's really, really transformed the way we build our world. And even something as simple as this LED flashlight, that's quantum technology, right? So transistor, big, big, big application. Another big quantum application is lasers. So laser light is a very, very beautiful, very pure kind of light, a quantum kind of light. We wouldn't understand how to build even like the laser in this little laser pointer here without first having understood how it is possible for atoms to exist, without having understood that quirky quantum behavior of electrons inside atoms, or in general, just the quantum nature of the universe at small scales. Very, very important. And of course, we can't live without lightsabers, right? Actually, probably the most important application in our day-to-day lives is with the internet. If you've downloaded something recently, then chances are that information has been encoded in the form of laser light sent down a fiber optic cable and reconverted into digital information in your computer. So if you've downloaded something recently, you've used that kind of quantum technology. So we live in an information age. You know, when we're using things like Google, Wikipedia, MapQuest, we can use those things in large part because of the power of ideas in that equation there. Really, really quite remarkable. Okay, actually, the list is quite endless for the ways in which quantum has impacted our world. So rather than just giving you a litany of zillions of things, I'll sort of categorize. So one big category of applications is in medical imaging technologies, life-saving technologies such as the magnetic resonance imaging. Okay, so this thing here, how many of you have been to the Physica Fantastica tent and seen the superconducting train? Okay, oh, lots of you, fantastic. That thing, superconductors, that's pure quantum technology. And that kind of technology is used in this magnetic resonance imaging device to create very, very strong magnetic fields to make that device work. There's actually many ways in which that device is pure quantum technology. Okay, so it gives us all kinds of life-saving medical kind of technologies like that. This is an electron microscope. And again, pure quantum technology. Electron microscope is way cool because it allows us to see things that are much, much smaller than we can see with an ordinary light microscope. So we can peer deep inside cells, the nucleus of cells, and then help us unravel the mysteries of life. Here's another very, very, very big problem that researchers around the world are working on, and that is, how is it possible for a very long DNA molecule to fold itself up into a gene? The geometry of that folding is very, very important in terms of what it means for our understanding of diseases, how diseases work, and possibly creating designer drugs and pharmaceuticals to treat those diseases. And physicists, biophysicists, and quantum ideas are helping researchers to solve that really, really important problem. So way, way cool. Nanophysics is another general category. This is remarkable to me that human beings have achieved the technological prowess to be able to build stuff out of individual atoms. That's really amazing. And of course, at the level of individual atoms, it's all quantum. The rules are different. It's quantum rules. Okay, so to be able to do that stuff, we need to understand the quantum nature of our universe. Okay, and that allows us to think about and design and work with all kinds of new materials, such as this guy. What is this guy? Carbon nanotube, right. So quantum ideas are helping us to design fantastic new materials, super strong materials, superconducting materials at higher and higher temperatures, and so on and so forth, all kinds of super materials. You know, some of the most advanced technology in the future is going to be built out of these new materials. Okay? And quantum ideas are playing a role in understanding how to design those materials. Really, really exciting stuff. And I wanted to leave you just with one last example here in the quantum land here, and that is the idea of a quantum computer. So how many of you were at the Physica Fantastica tent and saw the quantum computer? That's remarkable to me that we have a quantum computer in the parking lot of the Waterloo Town Square. Just amazing. And there's another one actually down the street at the Institute for Quantum Computing, headed up by Ray LaFlamme here. Okay, so we already know that that computers are quantum. They have transistors in them. Okay, so how does a quantum computer differ from an ordinary computer? Well, basically, the idea is that we are sitting on the potential right now to possibly make use of all of nature's quantum tricks. So right now, an ordinary computer just makes use of some of those tricks. A quantum computer would notch it up and take advantage of all of nature's quantum tricks to build an entirely new kind of computer. So this isn't like going from one level like Pentium to Core 2 Duo or something like that. This is an entirely different kind of beast. Okay, and just to give you a sense of how it might work, what we have, let's go back to our atom. So inside the atom, for atoms to exist, electrons need to be able to do this quirky thing of being able to behave as if they are in two places at once, two or more places. Okay, well, maybe in the language of quantum of computers, maybe what we could do is get a computer to do two calculations at once, or four, or eight, or 16, or a zillion calculations at once. So there is the potential to construct a machine which is able to do, which is able to make use of this quantum multitasking, this quantum parallelism, and do multiple calculations at the same time with the end result of increasing the computational power just absolutely exponentially, hugely. That's the potential. So I have this really cool video here with Professor Seth Lloyd at MIT talking about his quantum computer. So let's check this out. So this is a future possible.
Now, technology advances in giant steps, and with it comes an even greater capacity to transform humanity. For Professor Seth Lloyd, toying with some of the fundamental laws of nature is opening the door to the future. Lloyd's unique vision has helped spark a revolution in computer science. This experimental machine has the potential not only to supersede conventional computers, but the human brain also.
We're looking at a simple quantum computer. This thing that looks like a large beer keg over here, cooled with liquid helium, aka a quantum computer.
What this machine does is unlock the computing power contained within some of the smallest particles in the universe, atoms.
Or whimsically called a qubit.
Unlike the world we experience, atoms have an uncertain existence, where they can be here or there, or this and that, in the same moment. Within this strange phenomena lies a power that Lloyd is attempting to harness.
The question is then, what do you do with this? And the answer is, well, let's party, right? So if we take a quantum computer, what does a quantum computer do? The quantum computer does this and does that at the same time. You don't have to stop with just, you know, doing two things at once. You can do four things at once, or eight things at once, or 32 things at once, or a million things at once. And if you can figure out how to take advantage of this quantum multitasking, we can build computers that can do computations that no classical computer could do, even if it were the size of the entire universe. The technologies that we're developing now are the technologies that may be used 20 years hence to build, you know, laptop computers where you store bits of information on individual atoms. And such a computer, if you could store information on every individual atom in the laptop computer, in terms of raw processing power, would be much, 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 much more powerful than the human brain.
I find that really, really amazing. While we are not there yet, serious scientists are talking about the possibility of computers that are so powerful, a new kind of breed of quantum computer, that a quantum computer just ordinary sort of desktop size might be more powerful than an ordinary transistor computer constructed out of all of the atoms in the observable universe. That's like really amazing to me. That is just astounding. And if that comes to pass, if we are actually able to solve some of the problems and challenges that face us to reach that goal, I mean, that's going to be due to the power of ideas in that little equation there. It's really, really remarkable. So just by way of conclusion here, so let me just put the physics of innovation cycle back up. Remember that, always remember that the universe is still deeply mysterious. Okay, we have young researchers, brilliant young researchers, coming to Perimeter Institute to test their mettle against the universe itself, our understanding of reality, to push the boundaries of what we understand reality to be, and deepen that understanding. And if history has anything to say about it, that deeper understanding of reality might hold all kinds of fantastic promise for future technologies. So just to review here, everything that virtually all of high tech that we enjoy today can be traced back to, originates from one or more of these four equations: electromagnetism, special relativity, general relativity, and quantum. There is a tremendous power of ideas in those equations. So, you know, what makes the world go round? I say again, ideas. Those are four of the most powerful ideas human beings have ever had. Actually, okay, so what I've been focusing on in this presentation is the power of those ideas for giving us, for transforming our technologies. Okay, but of course, the impact has been much, much broader than that. If one thinks, for example, the impact on the economy and on jobs, absolutely enormous, almost incalculable. If you think about the information technology industry alone, that is a multi-trillion dollar industry, huge, huge impact on jobs and economy. But then there's also other kinds of impact, more social type impacts. Okay, and that's probably best illustrated with this, what has been called one of the most famous and influential environmental photographs of all time. This is called Earthrise. Right, so it was taken by Apollo astronauts as they came around the far side of the moon and they saw the Earth rising above the lunar horizon. And they thought, wow, that's beautiful. Let's take a picture. Okay, and then, so pictures of like this, of the whole Earth, have had a tremendous impact on the human psyche, a significant impact. It has shown us, it has sort of given us a greater appreciation of the fact that the world is small, it is precious, it is delicate, we need to take care of it. It has impacted our stewardship of the world. So the world faces major problems, serious, serious challenges. Okay? Energy, environment, hunger, population, disease. These are large, large problems which cannot be solved by any one nation. They need to be solved with a collective mindset, a global mindset. And pictures, this picture and pictures like it, have had a significant impact over time of helping us to get into that more global mindset. So again, I ask, where does that thing come from? What did we need to know about the basic way our world works, space, time, gravity, to get that picture? Well, we come full circle all the way back to who we started with, Sir Isaac Newton. He gave us the laws of motion, which allowed us to construct rockets to get us to the moon. He gave us our first understanding of what gravity is, that first level of understanding, which was sufficient to calculate trajectories and get us to the moon. Okay? So that kind of impact, I mean, that's the impact of basic science. That kind of impact is not measured in say, jobs or you know, dollars or economy. The kind of impact a picture like that has had on the world in changing our helping to change our global mindset is measured on an entirely different scale, a scale of will the human race survive or not? Enormous impact that basic science has on our world. Really, really positive, powerful impact. Okay, so I will leave you with that. Let me just invite you to check out our online resources. We have What We Research articles, great articles that explain what it is actually researchers here at Perimeter Institute are doing, pushing back the frontiers of our present knowledge, our present understanding of reality. We have fantastic Meet a Scientist clips, short little clips about scientists, as if you met them in the elevator. Hey, how you doing? What do you do? Why do you like science? That kind of stuff. Great, great short interviews with scientists, virtual science camps with all kinds of great information about physics, Perimeter Institute public lectures, which are very, very popular. And let me just thank you for all the great images and videos. And let me thank students and teachers from across Canada for having input, important input into this presentation. And thank you to Research in Motion for their generous support. And thank you for being here and listening. Thank you. That's it.
Thank you very much, Richard. I'm just breathless from the kaleidoscope of the power of ideas and the importance moving forward to planet Earth. We have time for some questions. We'll start with our online audience. Jennifer Dodd here begins.
So Saras from California asks, is there an underlying reality to existence? And if so, will we ever be able to understand it?
Is there an underlying reality to existence? That's a pretty deep question to start out with. Right now, essentially, our understanding of reality is everything that we understand about reality as physicists is in the language of mathematics. And anything that we attach to that mathematics, mental pictures and so on and so forth, is just in our own minds. Going beyond the mathematics, it is not clear what can be said beyond the mathematics. There's a certain sense in which, let me give you an example. So Maxwell, when he created those Maxwell's equations, he had in his mind a very, very concrete reality, a very like gears and wheels kind of reality, ether, a physical medium that is affected, that is an electromagnetic wave is a state of that ether. And he had little gears and wheels in there, that kind of very, very mechanical, concrete picture of reality. Okay? As time went on, people realized, in particular, it was Hertz who actually said it. He said, look, let's forget about all that stuff. We've just got the math. Just the math is all we need to understand what is going on, to understand reality. Anything else that we attach to it, it was extremely important. It's really important for physicists to help them go to the next step, because we have intuition that's based on mental pictures and so on and so forth. But ultimately, really, it just boils down to the mathematics. So I'm not sure that that theoretical physicist will give us sort of a reality beneath that.
I have a second question.
All right.
Zhang from Waterloo would like to know, there seems to be a pattern that technology often turns out to be something totally different than what people have envisioned. Why is it that our theory gives rise to the technology but doesn't predict its full power, and where does this unpredicted power come from?
So just generally speaking, what happens is really quite beautiful. So you can't, you can't predict everything. You can't control everything. So when people like Faraday and Maxwell, the two main people involved in electromagnetism, when they were working these ideas out, they were just thinking really about the ideas themselves. They had, especially Faraday, started out with these ideas, these mental pictures of electric field lines and they're under tension and where they're parallel, they're under pressure. He imagined this really, really, a world full of fields that are very physical and reality, that kind of stuff. He had that in his head. That's what he thought was cool. That's what occupied his mind. Maxwell comes along, he's more mathematical. He also had these kind of mental pictures, but he took all of that and put it in really succinct language of mathematics and pushed it forward and so on and so forth. When these people are doing this, they're doing it because they think electromagnetism is the coolest thing they've ever thought about. Okay? That's what's driving them. They're imagining how, I push a magnet this way and the magnetic field in this region of space increases. And what happens is there's a swirl of electric field and so on. They're seeing all this stuff in their heads. That's what's really turning them on. That's what's keeping them going. Okay? And then they come up with this theory. Along the way, they probably, I can't speak for Faraday or Maxwell, but probably they never really thought about the applications of this. And there's an anecdote here where someone in government, a government official, asked Faraday, so what's the practical value of this, electricity? And Faraday said, well, I really don't know, but I'm sure one day you'll find a way to tax it. And so the inventors of these technologies, the inventors of these basic ideas of how, pushing us forward in our understanding of reality, they're really focused on that. And the applications come later, typically come later. Okay, then other people get into it and say, yeah, that is a cool idea, and look, now that we understand that, it will allow us to do that. Someone thinks that. And then someone over here says, well, yeah, but we could also do that. And so it's not as if the creators of the idea are somehow dictating or controlling how that technology will be developed. It's just open to the world, the creative genius of humanity at large. And they just start, ideas come in, they start sparking around, someone talks to someone else, and another idea sparks, and it just goes in all different directions. Okay? And it just fills idea space over time. Okay? And so, and you can't predict where that's going to go.
Okay, one last question.
Tatiana from Toronto would like to know, real innovation so often comes from outside the box thinking and actions. How can we include innovation and creativity as part of every student's education as one of the basic literacy skills?
I think, okay, so one really important way to instill that or to help instill that in our students is to treat science for what it is. It is a journey of discovery. Science is not a bunch of facts. And oftentimes, sometimes that happens. We present science as, well, this was discovered, then this was discovered, we know this. And you know, once you get to the end of the textbook, then you know science. And science, because so much is known, because so much creative human genius has gone into looking around the world and figuring things out, we know so much. Okay? But of course, what remains to be known is much, much bigger. But we know so much. There's so much out there to know that sometimes we lose sight of the boundary. Real science is up here. Real science is pushing those boundaries. Real science is asking questions, being innovative, being creative. Okay? But to get to that stage, we need to learn a lot along the way. So somehow, it's important that students understand what has come before. But in that process, if we can get students involved in the actual process of science, creating new ideas, you know, looking at the world around them, maybe an experiment or something, and getting them to figure it out on their own, not telling them the answer, that sort of things like that. We really need to engage students in the process of science as early as possible, the process of questioning and being creative. And so it's basically creative thinking and critical thinking. Those are the two big powerhouses of how science works. And those two skills need to be developed side by side, and along with just all the huge amount of facts that we know or seem to know about our universe.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, John. Thank you.